This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Today we talk to a UAW member about how long the GM strike might go.
As long as it takes. You know, I'll find something else that I can do to support my family in the meantime if I have to.
And how could a prolonged strike affect Michigan's economy?
Every other person listening to this broadcast knows a person who's already lost some money, lost wages.
We learn about the dozens of cougar sightings in Michigan, then the economic impact of a private prison reopening in a small town.
I believe as a community of a whole, we're very happy that it is opening, and we're welcoming everybody to the community with open arms.
Our political commentators on the governor's ability to leverage budget talks.
Back to the bargaining table next week without dealing with the problems and implications of a government shutdown.
And we've got a cocktail for you.
To me, it tastes like drinking an apple pie.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. GM workers in the UAW just missed their first paycheck because of the strike. In a moment, we'll hear how that affects the Michigan economy. But to understand how that's affecting rank and file members, we've got to hear from Sean Crawford. He works at the Flint Truck Assembly Plant, and he's been with GM since 2008. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what's missing this paycheck mean to you and your family right now?
Well, it means we're in the beginning phases of our struggle to get what is fair and what is right in our contracts. I've been preparing for the strike since the beginning of the year, and, you know, I grew up fairly low income, so it's not something that that's foreign to me. I just want to make sure that we stay out as long as possible to get the contract that we all deserve.
Well, how long can you go on nothing but strike pay before finances become a problem?
Not as long as it takes. You know, I'll find something else that I can do to support my family in the meantime if I have to. But, you know, there's no reason that General Motors, after having the most profitable years in their entire history, at our expense, mind you, right, not only the taxpayers' expense through the auto loans, but also through all the concessions we've taken since 2007, it's time for them to give back what we've created through our labor, which we've made it one of the most successful auto companies out there. So time to get back what we've earned.
You have a baby on the way. Does that put more pressure on you?
You know, it definitely makes things a little more nerve-wracking. But at the same time, you know, my wife and I were pretty resilient people. And I know we're going to make it through whatever happens. You know, people had to go through a lot more to get what we take for granted today. And, you know, I want to make sure that we do our part for the next generation so they can have a decent standard of living and be treated fairly.
You mentioned you were preparing for this most of the year. How well prepared were your fellow union members?
I think my fellow union members are pretty well prepared. My brothers and sisters have been saving. They are aware of what's going on with the strike. I have not heard a single complaint from anybody yet. I think everybody is ready and willing to stay out as long as it's going to take.
Well, I'm wondering about the second-tier workers, the people on the line who make less money. They're going to be the hardest pressed to do something, right?
Well, yeah, them as well as the temps and then the subsystems workers as well, right? Because there's so many different tiers and classifications within the shop now, unfortunately. But at the same time, you know, if you make less money, you're used to living on less money. You're used to being more frugal. So I know a lot of my brothers and sisters who are making less money have been saving as well.
Are you going to lose support for the strike if they start suffering before the rest of you are hit like that?
I sure hope not, and I really hope that people understand the class nature of what's going on, right? I mean, as workers, you know, we only have one type of leverage, right, and that's the ability to withhold our labor. And so if we withhold our labor collectively, we can get back what we've earned, right? And so I think everyone needs to just have that basic understanding that holding out in the long run is going to be much better, not only for auto workers, but for the entire working class in the state and in the country, because it shows what's possible when working people come together.
You said you've been with GM since 2008. You've never been out on strike before, so you don't really know how a long strike might feel, do you?
Well, I grew up hearing stories from my family who've been through many long strikes, and you know they kind of prepared me growing up. They told me about the great sit-down strike that happened in Flint, you know, where it was right in the middle of winter when they had to occupy the plant, and you know the lengths that General Motors was willing to go to. You know, try to evict the strikers and using like World War One era, you know, gas inside the plants. And so things got pretty hairy. So, I mean, for me, a long strike, it's not going to be a problem. You know, people have went through a lot more hardship to achieve what is right because it's, again, it's not just about auto workers, but it's about the entire class, right? And we need to win the strike so we can be a good example for the rest of the workers in the state and this country. So hopefully they form their own unions and get back what they deserve.
Now, I know I'm sure that there are rumors flying on the picket line about whether you're close to an agreement or not close to an agreement. What's the scuttlebug?
It sounds like we're about 2 weeks away from any kind of potential agreement. I know that they've really, I'm just getting my information from the Free Press, you know, and other news outlets like everybody else. But I mean, after they get the main issues off the main table, it's going to have to be presented to the membership and voted on. And so it sounds like there's a lot of confusion in negotiations right now. First, we have insurance, then we don't. So I don't expect anything for another couple of weeks, to be honest.
Sean Crawford is a UAW member on strike. He's out of the GM Flint Assembly Plant, which produces full-size trucks. Thanks for taking a moment to talk with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yesterday, the Wall Street Journal published a report titled GM Strike to Ripple Through Michigan Economy. It included the statement that Michigan relies far more on the automotive industry for wage and salary income than the U.S. as a whole. The sector accounts for 7% of such income, compared with less than 2% nationally, according to a Moody's Investors Service report the piece cited. We thought we'd take a longer look at that with Patrick Anderson of the Anderson Economic Group. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I should mention you're quoted in that Wall Street story.
I think a lot of that Wall Street story is based on the work that our group has done, both in our Chicago office and our East Lansing office. We, of course, have been following the Midwestern economy, in particular the Michigan economy, for over 20 years. And if anything, those numbers from Moody's understate the reliance of Michigan's economy. I would put Michigan's economy as well more than 10% reliant on the auto industry. It's really our anchor industry. It's smaller than it once was as a share of the entire economy, but it's our cornerstone. That's whether there's a GM strike or not, we rely on the auto industry.
Let's break it down a little bit. Strikers just missed their first check since the strike started. That impacts union families, of course, but it also means spending is down in communities, income tax revenue is down for the state. How significant is that?
It's about $17 million lost per day, and a lot of that is in Michigan. In fact, about half of that. It's 600,000 lost income taxes to the state of Michigan per day this week, we estimate it. About $10 million a day lost in supplier wages, again, about half of that in the state of Michigan. So it's a significant chunk of money on a day-by-day basis. Just among the employees and the people that run small businesses who generally get paid, even if they're owners, out of whatever revenue they have from the business, that's quite a bit of money, and day by day it mounts.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, there are a lot of auto parts suppliers who rely on those GM plants. Will we start seeing layoffs, or have we seen layoffs already if this strike continues much longer?
I would have to venture a guess that every other person listening to this broadcast knows a person who's already lost some money, lost wages, didn't show up for work, or which is basically their hours are down. You have a whole number of employees that work for all kinds of businesses that are reliant on people that work in the auto industry, or they sell directly the auto industry. I mean, even my company, Anderson Economic Group, we have trade association clients, we have auto dealer clients, we have sometimes we have the automakers, and all of them, I would have to say virtually every single one of our Michigan business and trade association clients is connected or based in the auto industry. So even we're affected here. I mean, we're not cutting anybody's hours immediately, but the fact is that virtually every major organization that hires us has support coming from the auto industry. And so that means electricians, it means marketing people, pipe fitters, logistics folks, folks that work in the trucking industry, that deliver parts, that make parts. They're all being affected by this.
To show how vulnerable Michigan can be, there's the old adage that when the nation's economy sneezes, Michigan comes down with pneumonia. Michigan's economy already is not quite as robust as it was. How could this strike affect the state's vulnerability to a regional recession?
You're right. When the nation sneezes, Michigan catches a cold. And when the nation starts to get a little bit of cold, we get pneumonia. And certainly in the Great Recession, I mean, we were, I don't want to say push the metaphor, I mean, we were in the ICU, and cities like Flint and Pontiac, parts of parts of Detroit had depression-level unemployment. His statistics that went above 20% and no longer had the same meaning that they would when we're looking at, say, 7% or 8%. So we're still vulnerable to a serious downturn, and the automobile industry is particularly vulnerable when the economy goes down. People stop buying cars because they can still usually drive their older cars. And so we're vulnerable to that recession. The U.S. economy is slowing. Michigan's economy has been slowing. It's still good. Our unemployment rate is low. Until this fiscal year, we were getting our budgets done on time, and we had balanced budgets. So we were in pretty good shape, but we're vulnerable. And I think this GM UAW strike, and don't forget, we have Ford Chrysler coming up, is happening at a particular risky time.
Kind of bottom line it for us. What are you looking for? What's the next event you're looking for that you think will be significant in the long term for Michigan?
Now as we're talking right now, we're in this double witching hour here. We have no budget that's adopted, and we're 3 days away from the end of our fiscal year for the state government. And at the same time, our largest private sector employer is locked in a labor battle with the UAW. This is really a dangerous time for Michigan. Certainly, I would like to see a responsible budget adopted by the state government in time so there's no disruption. And I'd like a settlement in the GM UAW strike, and one also an avoidance of that and with the Ford and Chrysler and other things in a manner that lets us adapt to changes in the auto market, because changes are happening and they're going to happen in the future, and lets us remain competitive with the other operations, which are not only in Michigan, they're in other parts of the United States, and they're in other countries. If we can do that, I'm quite confident Michigan will do well. But if we don't, we have the chance to make two really boneheaded errors in the same month that would hurt us for a great deal of time. So we're vulnerable right now, and I hope cooler and smarter heads are prevailing both down in Detroit and in Lansing.
Patrick Anderson is the chief executive of the Anderson Economic Group. That's a Lansing-based consulting firm which, among other things, analyzes economic, industry, and market conditions. Thanks very much.
Good to be with you today.
Coming up, we'll talk about the growing number of cougar sightings in our state. Are they making Michigan home or just passing through? You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. I talked to the chair of the House Appropriations Committee, Representative Shane Hernandez, a couple of weeks ago about the proposed budgets. One of the things I asked about was this 9% cut in the Department of Natural Resources budget. He said it was because the department received some one-time funding, but we really didn't have the time to get into it all that much. So we've invited someone who keeps tabs on the Department of Natural Resources budget. Amy Trotter is the executive director of the Michigan United Conservation Clubs. That organization represents some 200 hunting, fishing, and other types of groups. Amy, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, so tell us what you know about this 9% cut in the DNR budget.
Well, I don't know if it's fair to say that it's exactly a cut in the budget. Some of that is just one-time funding that was not renewed in this New Year's budget. So some of these things, for example, one of our member priorities was a pilot program to release pheasants on state game areas. That was funded in last year's budget, and it's not going to be continued because it was a one-time funding for that pilot project.
So is the DNR basically in okay shape despite what appeared to be a cut?
Well, there are certainly some challenges in the budget. And so for our members who are primarily hunters, anglers, and trappers, we're looking at a few key things. Invasive species was continued to be fully funded in this budget, so it's been a pretty stable $5 million a year for the last several years, and that was retained. Chronic wasting disease is certainly a hot topic these days. And the executive budget asked for $2.3 million for chronic waste and disease. $2 million of that was one-time funding, whereas $300,000 of that was going to be ongoing. And when you look at the budget, it actually says that they approved that general fund money for the $2.3 million. But unfortunately, if you go down a few more lines, it says there's a wildlife management fund shift where they shifted $300,000 of that ongoing money, away from general fund and into some restricted funds, specifically forest development fund and turkey permit fees, which cannot be used for chronic wasting disease. So effectively, that's a cut, and they tried to be creative, I guess, with the accounting on that.
Okay, take me through that again. So you're watching this shift of turkey hunting fees. Exactly how did they manage that, and what does that mean for what doesn't get funded now?
Right. So in terms of chronic wasting disease, there's a lot of cost to this, and we want to do both research that is ongoing. We want to make sure that we're using the best available science, that we're working with academic partners and partners in other states to learn more about the disease. So that's really kind of where the $2 million comes in, is for that research arm. But there's continued and ongoing cost associated with running the wildlife disease lab, having surveillance, being available to check deer and test them. Right now, all of that is offered for free to hunters. We want to continue to make that free and available to hunters so that they have some peace of mind, and they're also helping with the surveillance efforts on the ground. But that $300,000 ongoing to infuse the lab with that kind of budget, unfortunately, it was supposed to be general funded through general fund monies, and they decided to try to take away that general fund but backfill it with turkey permit and forest development fund money. So in effect, it is a cut because you can't use those funds for that purpose in the wildlife disease lab. The budget bill is just an authorization to spend. So they're saying, DNR, you can spend turkey fees on this. But the DNR knows that those fees are actually constitutionally protected to only be used for turkey purposes. So they can't use it. So it's an effective cut. Even though they've said, I give you authorization to spend this money, the DNR knows better.
What's your overall view of the DNR's budget this year then?
We're fairly comfortable. It's certainly something that, you know, we saw some early conversations about some cuts that were in the end restored to conservation officers. We were pleased by that. And overall, we think it's reflective of, you know, really the base for which the department has to fund conservation here in Michigan. It is primarily a restricted fund and a user-funded entity and agency, and they really rely on their users to pay the bills. So hunters and anglers are footing the bills for nearly all of the fish and wildlife conservation in the state and a good portion of the law enforcement. So, you know, we would expect that they're continuing to use the revenues they expect to fund those things. You know, we are concerned with some, like I said, the fund shifts and, I guess if you want to call it, creative accounting there on those ongoing things that are a priority for our members. Another big concern that I saw in the conference report is a shift away, again, from general fund money for forest development wildfires to that restricted fund. So essentially, when there's a wildfire, and primarily these are started on private lands, or they are certainly implicated in private lands as they burn, you're using forest development funds money under this budget proposal to fight that fire rather than general fund money. So you're actually hampering your efforts in long-term management of the forest because it's burning up in the management of a forest fire. So that's not the way we want to do business. That is the way it has been done before, and we were starting to get away with that with some significant general fund monies that was going towards wildfire protection, but unfortunately they did move that to the restricted fund again, about to the tune of $630,000.
Amy Trotter is the Executive Director of the Michigan United Conservation Clubs. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Just this week, sighting number 41 of a cougar in Michigan was confirmed. We wanted to learn a little bit more about this, since until just a few years ago, the Department of Natural Resources was skeptical about cougar sightings. Last week, when the confirmation sighting number was still 40, we spoke with the DNR's large carnivore specialist in the Bear and Wolf program, Cody Norton. Hi there.
Hi.
First, I want to clear up something. I've been reading news reports that read, X number of cougars have been sighted, and I think I would have said there have been X number of sightings of cougars. So, in the state, 40 cougars or 40 sightings of cougars?
Yeah, that's a good point to make. Yeah, there's been 40 confirmed sightings, you know, where we actually had evidence that we could say without a doubt this is a cougar, but definitely we get pictures or tracks or scat from, you know, multiple examples of those from an individual cougar while it moves around. Obviously, they stand out, and if people happen to get a picture of them or anything else, they're usually going to share that.
Well, do we have an estimate of the number of cougars that might be in the state right now?
No, we do not have any evidence that suggests that we have a breeding population. So every cougar that we've been able to get a sex on, whether it's from a photograph or DNA evidence, or in the case of a couple of cougars that were actually poached, and we had the carcasses, all of those have been males, usually young males, which really just suggests that they're young males from western populations that took off. We call it dispersing. And they're basically looking for a new territory where they don't have to compete with other males, and pretty much they never find a female and just keep cruising, and we end up getting some traveling through.
Yeah, I was going to ask, are they permanent residents or just passing through? It sounds like they're passing through.
Yeah, we actually had one back in, I think, 2010, and that was a cougar that was actually from South Dakota that was documented in Minnesota, Wisconsin, the UP of Michigan, ended up going all the way over to Connecticut and got hit by a car.
They travel a lot, it sounds like, these young males.
Absolutely. They're kind of like young males of any species. They're out looking for females.
Are cougars a protected species in Michigan?
Yep. They are considered endangered by the state, so they're categorized as endangered. So, yep, they cannot be harvested.
One thing that's been suggested is that some of these cougars might be former pets that were let loose. Is there any evidence behind that?
I think in other eastern states, like along, you know, closer to the eastern seaboard where they've shown up, there is evidence that they are released pets. You know, they've done genetic analyses, and they actually are South American stock, you know, from South American populations. The cougars that we've been able to do DNA analysis on have belonged to those populations that are associated with South Dakota, Nebraska, or Wyoming. So they seem to be, you know, probably just dispersing males and not released pets.
Let's talk a little bit about history of cougars in Michigan. Any idea how many cougars might have been around prior to European settlement?
You know, before European settlement, just in general, I mean, they were the most widely distributed land mammal in the Western Hemisphere. So, like I said, they were, you know, they were in North America. They were also in Central and South America. And so we don't really have a population estimate of what would have been in Michigan specifically, but they were widely distributed. They were very abundant.
Are cougars mentioned much in early histories of the state or histories of the counties?
Yeah, one of the best records I think we have of cougars is just, you know, most of the states back then had bounties on them. So they would pay hunters and trappers to kill cougars. And basically, you know, the early settlers viewed cougars as a danger to livestock and humans and competition for wild game. So, you know, those old records of, you know, paying bounties to people to kill them are kind of one of the best tools we have.
So we can blame state government for the disappearance of cougar population, it sounds like.
Sure.
As I mentioned, the Department of Natural Resources was skeptical about cougar sightings, suggesting people saw bobcats or something else. Now that we've confirmed there are cougars at least passing through the state, do you have any idea when they first started kind of traveling through Michigan?
You know, we've confirmed, obviously, with the, you know, the advent of trail cameras, that has helped a ton with getting, you know, good evidence that doesn't wash away in the rain or melt in the sun, where we can verify reports. You know, we were able to confirm one, I think, as far back as 1998. We had a highly likely one in 2004. And so basically as a response to that, we created a cougar team that's made up of, you know, wildlife biologists that are trained to identify cougars. And so then starting in 2008, we had kind of an established protocol for how we were going to investigate any cougar sightings that came up. And so we've had those 40 different confirmed sightings of cougars have all been since 2008, and that's kind of how we now keep track.
Well, there's one guy I was reading somewhere, I forget now, but he had a cougar on his trail cam, but he said he'd been seeing them since the 1970s. Is that likely?
You know, so we actually have a reporting form online now where people can go on and submit reports of cougar sightings or any evidence that they might have. And I'll tell you, we get a lot every week, you know, and usually, you know, a portion of those will have evidence, and we get pictures of house cats, we get pictures of bobcats, we get pictures of fishers. You know, we've kind of, you know, it's just our job to wade through and try to figure out the ones that we can tell 100% are cougars. I think there is a lot of misidentification, or, you know, you see a flash of something, and sometimes your mind sees what it wants to see. So, you know, that's why we rely on evidence that, you know, is incontrovertible, that we know that's a cougar, and those are the ones we're going to document.
Okay, I'm out on a trail. I turn around, I go around this rock, and there's a cougar standing right in front of me. What should I do?
In terms of trying to document it, or
yeah, well, I'll be taking pictures of after I get after they get my heart out of my throat. But yeah, what should I do? I mean, am I in danger? How badly am I? Do I run? Do I, you know, wave? What do I do?
Sure. So, you know, most of the time when you see incidences between cougars and people, you know, they do happen. You know, for the most part, that's going to be out west in, you know, robust populations where you've got a lot of animals. You know, your chances of running into one in Michigan are extremely low. But if you do know, in general, you don't want to run from a cougar or any other large carnivore. You're going to want to face the animal, look as big as you can, you know, wave your arms, talk to it in a loud voice. Just try to kind of show that you wouldn't be something easy to take down. If you do, you know, look into attacks that happen out west, a lot of times it's people that are running or biking or moving away from the animal at a fast rate. And with cougars, that can kind of trigger a, you know, an attack out of them because it feels like it's prey that's running away from you that you should chase.
Yeah, I think I'd have a hard time grabbing my camera fast enough.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you were to see something like that, you know, maybe it left tracks, maybe there's scat in the area, so you can certainly still give us a call and report that, and we'll try to document it as best as we can.
Cody Norton is a large carnivore specialist with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources Bear and Wolf Program. Hey, thanks for telling us about cougars in Michigan.
Thanks for having me on.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. I'm Lester Graham, and we're here with another episode of Cheers to Michigan. Fall-like outside, and that looks like what you had in mind.
Definitely getting into the season where I like to think about fall flavors in my cocktails.
Well, what kind of flavors are we talking about in this particular cocktail? It looks like we've got Moonshine.
So this is from Wiseman Distillery. They're just outside Grand Rapids, and they make a variety of different products, and what I'm using today is their apple pie moonshine. So it starts off with a base of their corn with a little bit of barley moonshine. That basically means an unaged whiskey. And then they steep it with a whole bunch of spices and then some Michigan apple juice concentrate. And to me, it tastes like drinking an apple pie.
There are, on the shelves of the liquor stores these days, a lot of things calling themselves apple pie, which I don't know whether they're going to the same kind of work you're talking about.
I think there's a lot of variability, right? Some things, especially the apple whiskeys, are really just using flavoring and can, to me, have kind of an artificial taste and aren't really something I want in my glass. And then other people are taking more of an artisan approach. So it's really kind of a buyer beware issue.
Okay. Well, what's this drink called and how do you make it?
I'm calling it the apple pie of my eye, and it's a very simple example of the sour template. It's So our base spirit here is 1.5 ounces of vodka, which I also use the Wise Men Distillery vodka. And then it's got 0.75 ounces of their apple pie moonshine and just 0.5 ounces of lemon juice. Shake it up with ice, strain it off into a glass, and we'll see what you think.
There's a guy I know who has a Halloween party. He always has a version of apple pie that he makes, so I'm not sure how he makes it. I do know it's potent, but let's see what this is like. It's got more citrus note than his does. It's not as cloyingly sweet as his is. This is more, to my mind, more drinkable.
I will say that the moonshine on its own is quite cloyingly sweet. Great for drizzling over ice cream, or if you're a person who likes sweet drinks, you know, sipping on it on its own over some ice would be great. To me, on its own, it's a little too sweet, but that's why I really like it in this sour application, because all the flavor comes out without so much of the sweetness.
And that lemon adds a lot to it. Well, that is the apple pie of my eye. Thanks very much.
Cheers.
Cheers. Still to come, a new private prison opens next week in Baldwin in northern Michigan. It will house immigrants who have been convicted of crimes. Some in the small town are hopeful it will bring a much-needed economic boost.
Their new employees would work in the area, live in the area, bring family to the area. So hopefully that will be a big boon to the real estate market and then also to the rest of the businesses.
But critics say the prison operator is taking advantage of the community's need for investment. We'll hear from both sides after the break. You're listening to Stateside. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Next week, a private prison will open in northern Michigan to house immigrants convicted of crimes. Critics say these privately run prisons are harmful to inmates, and they claim prison operator Geo Group is taking advantage of a desperate community. But Interlochen Public Radio's Taylor Wisner reports many residents do support the correctional facility.
The facility will hold immigrants only, those with legal papers and those without, who are convicted of crimes. Public records requests show about half of the inmates were incarcerated because of drug charges. The Bureau of Prisons data shows immigrants serve 6 years on average, and when they're done, they are deported. The immigrant segregated prison is in the village of Baldwin. With a population of 1,000, the popular recreation town is located 40 minutes east of Ludington. But the county struggles with a high unemployment rate, and 60% of its residents are on government subsidies. Still, Baldwin Village President Jim Truxton thinks the area is about to turn around. On an overcast day, he is standing outside the prison. For years, he has been a big GEO supporter. He bought stock in the company and recently toured the facility.
I've lived in dormitories that didn't look as nice, you know, college dormitories that didn't look as nice as this facility.
Geo Group built it a decade ago to hold juvenile offenders in Michigan, but later the state canceled the contract. It mostly sat empty until May, when the U.S. government awarded Geo Group a 10-year contract to hold up to 1,800 immigrant prisoners. Geo says the agreement will net the company $37 million annually. Truxton says he wrote several letters of recommendation for job applicants and knows at least a dozen local people who got jobs there.
Husband and wife team, friends of mine. She was an aide at the school. He worked for one of the local restaurant pizza places, and they're both working here now at starting wages of $17 an hour. $17 an hour, 40 hours a week, it's about $34,000 a year plus benefits.
Geo Group contributed to renovating the local sewage treatment plant and has provided millions in property taxes. Truxton says the company is well-respected locally, even as people lost their jobs when the company's past contracts ended unexpectedly.
People get to stay in the area they love. They get to stay close to family and friends. Our one of our biggest issues in this county for several decades now is the kids all leave because they don't feel there's an economic future for them here.
Geo Group did not make anyone available for an interview. Truxton says the employees were also told not to speak with reporters. On the sidewalk in downtown Baldwin, half a dozen people interviewed were in favor of the prison. At the Village restaurant, chair of the Lake County Democrat Party, Mary Minnick, says when she heard the prison would be open for at least 10 years, she was excited.
I originally put on our Lake County Democrat Party page that they were hiring. This was good for the community. You know, here's the event. These are the jobs. This is what we need, right?
But she says she soured on the prison after hearing most of the 300 jobs would not go to locals. In an email, GEO Group says they've hired 69 residents from Lake County. They say the remaining 200-plus employees commute from nearby or are in the process of moving closer. Immigrant-only prisons in other states have been criticized for their conditions. New York University law professor Emma Kaufman spent 6 months doing interviews and requesting public documents on immigrant prisons.
From what we can tell, there are higher rates of violence and self-harm in these institutions.
She found these prisons provide fewer medical and rehabilitative services for immigrant inmates.
Institutions that are transient, institutions that are really remote, institutions where there lacks security, all of those things can contribute to rates of violence.
She says the prisons are all in rural areas, which also brings a host of problems.
So remoteness presents huge challenges in terms of access to courts, access to counsel, access to family. I mean, family visitation is probably the biggest concern about long distance.
Meanwhile, the prison is expected to get up and running starting October 1st. Minnick says she is organizing a protest across the street on the same day. For Stateside, I'm Taylor Wisner.
Let's now hear more about the economic impact of the GEO prison. Leanne Russell is the president of the Lake County Chamber of Commerce. Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome, sir.
So when the prison closed back in 2017, how hard was the Lake County economy hit?
As far as I'm aware, it was very tough on all of the people that were hired and got let go. As far as the community is concerned, we survive.
Did the merchants?
Only because we have to.
I was going to say, did the merchants see it down? Did they lose business because of that in a substantial way?
Well, I'm sure that the and everything else did lose business in restaurants. As far as the regular businesses, I'm not aware how drastic it was, a change, but I know it did affect some of them.
With this reopening as an immigrants-only prison, what kind of economic benefit are you expecting now?
I would say that probably we would expect that maybe the new employees would work in the area, live in the area, bring family to the area. So hopefully that will be a big boon to the real estate market and then also to the rest of the businesses.
Visitors to prisons often visit restaurants, buy gas, and so on. Are you expecting an immigrants-only prison to have as many visitors and the same kind of economic benefit to local merchants?
I would think that probably it would, because the other one didn't have as many visitors either.
The report from Interlochen Public Radio indicated GEO has hired 69 Lake County residents. That's about one out of four jobs. Is that enough to your mind?
If they pass the qualifications, absolutely. There are specific qualifications being hired, and the person wanting to be hired can pass it, then definitely.
Would you like to see more Lake County residents hired?
Absolutely, if they apply for the jobs. They have to apply in the first place.
Right. Some people disagree with the federal government's current immigration policies. You could see protesters in the county in Baldwin. How do you think the community will react to that?
If the community reacts to it, I believe they'll react in a very positive measure, because we want this business to succeed. And I don't think that type of thing should happen here. We are a very good community that loves people and tourists and everything else that happens here.
But still, there are going to be people from outside of the community who are going to visit more than likely and protest because of their opposition to what's happening regarding immigration policy. How will these people be received?
Probably with open arms. But they don't understand our community, and unfortunately, they have their own decisions to make, so I just feel that they've got to live with the decision they make.
This contract is for 10 years. What happens to Lake County after that? I mean, you just get to the point where you're used to this kind of economic impact, but it might be only a decade long.
10 years is better than none. And when you have something that opens and closes and opens and closes, contracts can be broken. This is a 10-year contract, and it can be broken. So we just live with the consequences that happen.
Is there anything else you'd like to know, let us know about as far as this person reopening again?
What I'd like you to know is that I believe as a community of a whole, we're very happy that it is opening, and we're welcoming everybody to the community with open arms.
Leanne Russell is the president of the Lake County Chamber of Commerce. Thanks for talking with us.
You're very welcome, and have a lovely week.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The state of Michigan is days away from its budget deadline. Governor Gretchen Whitmer says the budgets she's been sent by the legislature are a mess. Here to give us a little insight of what's going on in Lansing are our political commentators. T.J. Buchholz is president of Vanguard Public Affairs, a progressive political strategy firm. He worked for Governors Engler and Granholm and headed up communications for Lieutenant Governor John Cherry. Ken Sikkema is a senior policy fellow for Public Sector Consultants. He's a former Republican majority leader of the Michigan Senate. So, T.J., what does the governor mean when she says the budgets she received are a mess?
Well, Lester, certainly the negotiation process for the budgets has been quite a bit different than would be typical from previous years. The legislature passed budgets kind of without her input, and I'm certain that there are things in the budgets that she's received to this point. And again, she still has not received the budgets that she's supposed to have gotten by now. I think she has some real concerns and differences in what she sees from the Republicans and what she'd like to be able to sign. So I don't think we're out of the woods yet from a budget negotiation perspective. I would expect that the governor is going to veto or line item veto many things in those budgets next week, and then they're going to have to go back to the drawing board to figure out how they reach a compromise.
Ken, the Republican leadership in the legislature says if the governor wanted something else in these budgets, she should have not walked away from the budget negotiations. How fair is that assessment of what happened?
Well, I just hopefully things are going to be different next year, because this is no way to run a railroad. She's got her priorities. They have their priorities. I think it's a bit over the top to say she walked away from any negotiations, since the road issue and transportation funding just never really got traction, and that was a key issue to her. I think try to have some perspective on all of this. She made her first offer in the spring when she presented her executive budget, and what the Republicans did this week, or are doing, in my judgment, is kind of their counteroffer, and her response will be her counter to their counter. And I think what should have been done in May, that is negotiate a budget, will be done in October.
Right. Governor Rick Snyder pushed for ending that budget process months earlier. For 8 years, we saw that. Now we're up against the budget deadline and might even see a partial state government shutdown. What does this all tell you about divided government? TJ?
Well, certainly, I think a lot of people like to pretend that, well, the Republicans were in control of the legislature and they had a Republican governor, so it was very easy for them to pass a budget. And that's just not necessarily true either. There always are differing priorities, and you dicker on a budget, I think, always. And I think Governor Snyder always tried to, have some sort of compromise. This is sort of uncharted territory, I think, in terms of where we've been. In terms of the procedure here, it's also been concerning because, according to the Constitution, the governor is supposed to have 14 days to review any budget bill sent to her desk. The budgets have not yet been transmitted to her in bulk. I mean, she's received a few budgets. I think she's received four or five of them. She hasn't received all of them. They have not been officially transmitted from the legislature. So it's difficult to know what's in those bills. And I actually think that the GOP leaders are playing a bit of a game with her, trying to make her seem less relevant. And I think that that's probably going to backfire. I don't think, as Ken said, that you want to play budget chicken with a governor anytime you're in an acrimonious process. And again, regardless of what the Republicans want to accomplish, they still need her signature on these documents. And unless she feels that these budgets are responsible, she's not going to sign all of them. That's for sure.
Ken?
Well, I'd be cautious about making a judgment about divided government. I still think, because this is the first year after many years where you have a Republican legislature and a Democratic governor, I think they're still kind of testing each other and seeing what process is going to work. And like I said earlier, hopefully things will be different next year. But I still think they're kind of in a testing mode.
What do you think of that point that TJ just made about the 14-day notice of a budget for the governor, and we're facing up the deadline on Monday, and she still doesn't have some of the budgets?
Well, that's a valid point. I mean, what he's referring to is the fact, not just for the budget, but she has 14 days on any bill that's been presented to her to decide whether to sign it or veto it. And, you know, because you have the state budget year starting October 1, Republicans have sort of, end-runded that 14-day issue. But she's got a lot of power with line item vetoes and other mechanisms at her disposal to basically force both sides back to the bargaining table next week without dealing with the problems and implications of a government shutdown.
Real quickly, at a recent Republican conference on Mackinac Island, Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky said about road funding that maybe we have paved too many roads. Maybe we ought to let some of them go back to gravel roads. What do you guys think of that?
You know, it's an inelegant statement, but there's a larger point there, that is the following. If you're not going to raise the revenue to maintain the current system, then you've got to rethink the current system. Now, it doesn't work to turn some roads into gravel, because he's not talking about state roads. He's probably talking about local roads. And the real cost to fix the roads are the main traveled expressways and state highways.
TJ?
Well, certainly I think that that's just a lot of rhetoric. And I would say to Senator Shirky, if graveling roads is a priority for you, I would say let's gravel the roads in your district first and see how your constituents respond to that. Ask anyone who lives in a gravel road, who has tried to get it paved with their local county road commission, and ask them about the cost of maintaining even a gravel road. And it's significant. Again, I think that there's almost a false premise here that, well, a gravel road, you turn it back, you take a paved road, turn it back to gravel, and then then you don't have to maintain it. In some cases, maintaining a gravel road is time consuming and can be as expensive as maintaining blacktop. So I don't think that gets us anywhere in terms of trying to take our state backward and gravel more roads. I understand the budget implications of it, but to suggest that there is no cost to maintain gravel roads is just uninformed.
TJ Buchholz is president of Vanguard Public Affairs, a progressive political strategy firm. He worked for Governors Engler and Granholm and headed up communications for Lieutenant Governor John Cherry. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow for Public Sector Consultants. He's a former Republican majority leader of the Michigan Senate. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
In the week ahead on Stateside, October 1st is the state's budget deadline. We'll find out where the Republican legislature and the Democratic governor stand on a spending plan. Also, we'll talk about the cost of replacing old drinking fountains in schools with filtered hydration stations. And we'll get a preview of Michigan Radio's newest podcast, Same, Same, Different. All of that in the coming week on Stateside. Today, Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Joe Lenstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber-Davis, Adam Reyes, and Tad Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.